Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to True Crime Radio. Actually, Web Sleuth Radio is what we call our wonderful show. And the deal was, we were not going to have another show on, at least in the near future, about the killing season. But of course, the second we say that, all hell breaks loose, and everything just comes flying in. It has just been a wild ride this past week. Now, last week, during the show, we found out that the unidentified toddler is the child of a victim known as Peaches. Okay? We didn't know that last week. We thought the toddler was the child of Jane Doe number 3. It turns out number 3 and Peaches are one in the same. The killer not only dismembered Peaches, but put her body parts in two totally separate areas to confuse the investigation, and that's exactly what happened. We also have an affidavit from a sex worker claiming that former police chief James Burke did some pretty rough things with her. We'll be talking with John Ray tonight, an attorney, about that. We also have ripperologist Robert Anderson, Hawkshaw from Web Sleuth, and we have Josh and Rachel coming up here in just a few minutes, Todd Matthews with Namus. But, Josh, let's go to you first. Did I do the recap of the week pretty good?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely been a crazy week. There was the Peaches thing, which was really just breaking, I think, when we spoke last. And I think we've had a little time to think about what that really means. And then, as Rachel tell you, I think what it was like 2 days later, we got a tweet from a woman who has Leanne is the name that she's using. And she has since hooked up with John Ray, and she has, you know, there was a big press conference where she claims that she had sex with James Burke, the former police chief of Suffolk County, who's now incarcerated, doing 46 months for violating civil rights of Chris Loeb, who's an individual who broke into his car and stole some items from his car. In that car was a duffel bag, and in the duffel bag there was quote-unquote nasty porn. We still don't quite know exactly what the nature of that porn was, although you can make some inference from the nasty porn. And she says that she had sex with Burke in a sex party at Oak Beach the summer after all the bodies were found.
Okay.
And so the crazy thing, and it, you know, it's really sad, I guess, is the fact that Burke was having sex with prostitutes, with sex workers, only a couple months after and a few short miles from where they found the bodies of 11 individuals. So it really just calls into question how hard he was trying to solve this case originally.
And I think the inference is this is one of the reasons why he didn't want the FBI to come in for the list killings, is because he had his hands dirty, and he didn't want them to get that close to the case. And you know what? I don't care how much he is denying that he had anything to do with the killings. He brought this on himself. I'm not saying he's guilty, but any heat he's feeling now, he did himself. It's just disgusting what he has done, and I'm glad he's a former chief. We have Josh Zeman, one of the creators of The Killing Season on A&E, and Rachel Mills, also the creator of The Killing Season. And Rachel, you're with us here. Just before we get to Todd Matthews, let's get your take on everything that's happened this week.
Well, you know, I know that we'll be talking about it a little bit with Todd Matthews. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I think you might have a radio on in the background, maybe.
No, I don't.
No, okay. Yeah, you sound good. You're good.
Okay. You know, we haven't gotten any clues, any leads to this case in years. Not quite sure what police are doing. I'm sure they're doing something, but, you know, they're not being extremely transparent, so we don't know exactly what they're doing. But when Todd comes on, we'll talk about this. And we talked about it last week, is that now we know Peaches is actually the mother of the toddler, which in my opinion is one of the biggest breaks in the case we've had in a long time. That extends the killer's kind of forensic footprint, his hunting area, for lack of a better phrase, or his dumping area. You know, it makes it so much bigger. So now we have to include Peaches. Again, we don't know what the implications are going to be later on for this, but I think it's very interesting, and it's something I've been thinking about for the past week since we now know that Peaches is one of the victims of, probably what we're calling the Manaville Butcher.
Right.
Right. So do you think that now a lot of people think there were two killers? Now, does this make it easier to assume it's only one killer or not?
That's a good question. I think this information has really kind of even muddied the waters further, if you will. And here's kind of why. If we now know Peaches was killed in 97, then we can not definitely, but more reasonably say that Fire Island Jane Doe was an earlier victim. So we have Fire Island Jane Doe dismembered in 96. We have Peaches dismembered in 97. We have, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Rach, it was Jane Doe number 6 in 2000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Jessica Taylor in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have 4 years later, the first victim of the GB4 who disappeared in 2007.
That's
so
correct.
So in that 4 years, do we have a different killer? Or as somebody pointed out to me today to remind me, as Joel Rifkin says, that he was dismembering and then stopped dismembering. Or in that 4 year time, did the same individual just stop dismembering his victims? And mind you, we also don't know when Asian male was dumped. When Asian male was killed. So we're unclear of the timeline there, but of the GB4, we know the first one disappeared in 2007. So I don't know. For me now, I'm kind of 50-50. It's crazy.
Yeah, you know, and just to piggyback on that, it's interesting because we always thought, and I've been on websites in the past week talking to people, we always thought from the information that was given to us about the toddler, about how long that toddler had been out there. You know, it was wrapped in a blanket. On Namus, it said it was, you know, a year. It's like at least a year. So when we see things like that, for me as a layperson, I think, oh, well, then the child was, you know, there maybe a few years. So now we actually know the toddler was most likely dumped there, you know, in 97, probably around the same time the mother is. And that just makes me think, talking about Asian male, you know, we don't know when that individual was dumped there. If we thought at one time the toddler was dumped there within like 3 years of actually being found in 2011, who knows when Asian male was actually dumped there?
Well, I don't think we can say for sure that we know that's when the toddler was dumped there or that's when the toddler was killed. You know what I'm saying? Because that's really the issue. You know, the big issue that comes up for me, and, you know, and this is one of the things that we talk about on Robert Anderson's site, which is, how do we know when all those other victims were either killed, or we know when they might have been killed, but we don't know when they were dumped on Ocean Parkway, and that's really the issue.
I'll tell you what, let's bring in Todd Matthews now. Todd Matthews is with NAMIS, that's National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, and Todd, you are such a wonderful help. We're so happy to have you on again this week. And what do you think of all of this? Has anything changed your opinion, perhaps, off your theory?
We've had a lot of thoughts. I didn't expect to be back so soon for one thing, but this is an interesting turn of events. And, you know, I think I've told Josh and Rachel that if this had been in another case in another city, another state, you know, remains are often connected in this manner, so it might not have even been noticed. But this being a hot-button case, it didn't take long for people to see it and react to it, and it can be overwhelming. I had a lot of calls earlier, you know, about this particular one day last week. I had a lot of interviews that come up as a result of it. And we got to clarify a few things, too. I think a lot of people felt like a new DNA test had been performed, and, you know, that wasn't the case. It was just an update of an existing file. So, but I think the chaos was something new had happened, and I made the statement, this isn't a forensic breakthrough. This is a case file revision at a request. And
right.
That's what happened.
Can I ask, so, mm-hmm. and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm not asking you to speak for law enforcement, but I was later told that they knew this information for at least a year and a half. This is Suffolk County and Nassau County. They knew that Peaches was Jane Doe number 3 through DNA for at least a year and a half before this information was made public last week.
And I didn't speak to any individual that made that comment or specific statement, but that's what I would believe to be so. I would believe that they would have known this, and I think maybe that's the reason they didn't create a profile for the extremities, is because they knew the case was already in the system. And at some point in time, I'm sure that through the natural process, changes of jurisdiction, I think they would have ultimately have entered the extremities into the file. I think the inquiries, and it became pretty clear, you know, when we were talking earlier, there was no file for Nassau County. Well, you know, we kind of think, well, maybe, but I didn't see any connection there. And then we requested, and when we heard it, I almost thought it was a mistake. But it wasn't a mistake.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. The reason why this became public was because by law they had to reveal this information?
No, I think it was a response to the question. I told you the best thing to do was, you know, I could see some things that I kind of felt like maybe were a certain way, and I thought maybe you should write to them. You know, you're the one asking the questions. Maybe you should write to them. The response
right.
came back, and at first I thought, well, it couldn't be. Could it?
Right.
So we asked for it to be validated. You know, one of my staffers did, you know, work to validate that, and, you know, we were told indeed this is true. There didn't seem to be any hesitation with it, and certainly the people that I've spoken to didn't have any hesitation to confirm that.
So,
and
why
this
didn't
kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rach.
No, I was going to say, like, this kind of thing, it happens quite often. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Two different body parts, maybe in the system or maybe not, and then ends up being the same individual.
That's not unusual at all. You know, they could even be in a different state and be connected. You know, when you find a foot or a jawbone and that's all you find, the likelihood that, you know, and a lot of people say remains were found. They don't realize partial remains could be just two or three bones, just enough
right.
to know that it's a human being, and there could be multiple scattered bones. Sometimes they're found many, many, many years later and are associated to a case that there's already been an identification on. That happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in
but
a
high-profile
case with an audience, that's a little different. It's a little different.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to find out, did they know and they didn't tell anybody, and why did they suddenly reveal that information? And I know you can't speak for them, but can you do some kind of conjecture here?
Well, I know that it was revealed to us because we asked, and that comment was given to us. You know, you wrote a letter. I had spoken up saying, can I assist in any way? That's a response that I received. And at first I did not believe it. I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm misreading this, you know, because sometimes the wording can be a little misleading. You think, okay, but I'm not really sure. I want to make sure. So I handed it to one of the staff, and they eventually added it to the file. We don't do that unless we validate it. So by that time, we know that it had to be true.
Now, can I ask you one other question? Sorry, Rach.
Okay.
Has there been any information on Peach's identification or since this information was revealed? Because as Rach said, we have a lot more information now about Peach's and mm-hmm. Baby Doe. We now know that we're looking for a mom and a toddler back in
mm-hmm.
97 and 96.
Mm-hmm. It does change the dynamics. It can drastically change the dynamics. We know more about that person now. Do we have any more identifiers than we already had? No, we don't. We do not have fingerprints still, and we still do not have a head, which would preclude dental records. So we still have just DNA. Does it paint a better picture of that individual? Yes, it does. But as far as human identification purposes, it didn't do a lot to help me do my job. It clarified some things. I think it got people thinking in a different way, but it didn't really give me any new forms of identification, which is unfortunate. I wish it did, but I think, you know, unraveling part of this, you know, if there's somebody out there that doesn't want this to be unraveled, so hopefully it sends a message. Eventually it gets picked apart.
Mm-hmm.
We're in this to win it. You know, we want to make sure that we identify this person, that somebody ultimately has to pay for it. That's our goal. That's what we want to see happen.
Well, there's a person who works for us, Caitlin Crawford, and she has been tirelessly kind of going through, and Caitlin has a theory. She wants to know whether or not this the child could be she was last seen, she was 2 years old, she was last seen November 13th, 1993, from Amityville, and her name's Tiffany Susan Westford. And I'm going to give you the NamUs number, 8479. Can you tell me if that's an exclusion, if this person is excluded?
Not right offhand. If an exclusion goes in, it will be added to that file. So
okay.
I can process it. You'll be able to see it in public view. So it's 8479, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, 8479. That's what Caitlin believes. And I promised her we would ask this evening.
Well, I will definitely put that into the stack, and if we have enough mechanism to exclude and we can put it into the file, those are publicly viewable, and that's the best way. And I have a lot of people that will say, will you call me back and tell me? And it's like, usually, no, we can't, but we have made sure that that's part of public view so people can go back, and if there's enough information to compare and exclude, we can do that.
Okay. Yeah, and Todd, I just want to go over a little bit because I know, obviously, people such as web sleuthers are now going back to all these records and trying to figure out who this Peaches person may be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's great to just have a name and say, oh, it's because of this person, you know, there's earrings, and I think it's this person. But can you kind of explain the best way for people to go about giving a tip? I know you and I spoke before, and that, mm-hmm. you know, it's great to have, like, I believe it's because A, B, C, D, E, and F. In addition to that, like, I think it's important for us to try to exclude as many people as possible. That
mm-hmm.
for law enforcement is going to be extremely helpful so that they're not inundated with the same person over and over again, because a lot of times the police already have all these people who people are turning in, but they just can't say it's not that person because they don't have DNA, they don't have dental records, they don't have fingerprints.
You know, they can exclude mentally. We don't exclude unless we exclude with biometric reasons. So unless I can exclude
mm-hmm.
dental DNA or fingerprints, we don't add them to it. And currently, if somebody made that exclusion with the biometric outside of the system, there's no real way other than to go and just initiate an exclusion. Usually the exclusions are issued as a result of case matching, throwing, you know, the system suggested possibilities, and then you click the button saying, I'm excluding this person. So if an exclusion is made outside of NamUs, it's harder for it to find its way to NamUs because somebody would have to come in and purposely insert file into folder. And it's not part of the comparison process. And it can be done. It happens every day. But, you know, a tip to this web sleuth community, cyber sleuth community as a whole, so many times I'll just get a link. I think Peaches is
yep.
this person, and I'll get a link to a random – and it's like, you didn't explain to me what it is that made you believe this to be a match. I need something, you know, because otherwise – we're going to have to read through it and find, okay, what is it that made you believe this? So you're probably missing a very compelling piece of information. Was it a backpack? Was it a material? Was it something that maybe the algorithm won't pick up in case matching? That's what we
mm-hmm.
need to hear. And the chances are, if the missing and unidentified are both in NamUs, the chances that somebody has probably already looked at it and simply didn't have the biometric to exclude probably already know it. It's a good possibility that somebody's already been flagged, but there was no mechanism to exclude. You know,
right.
Can't exclude on dental records of Peaches, period. There's no way I can do that.
Right.
So, unfortunately, in some cases we do. We've entered several exclusions into cases, you know, just trying to help with the process of elimination to jumpstart things, to show law enforcement how powerful this tool really is and how beneficial it could be if they use it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have a quick question, though. Because this information is so recent, because we know that now Peaches and the baby can be traced back to 97, even if this person who Caitlin found is already in Namath, does that still exclude them because maybe there's in Namath for a different reason, but now that we can, you know, trace this person back to 97, those wouldn't necessarily – she wouldn't have been entered because of an exclusion, I'm saying.
Well, I think, and a lot of it, you know, the exclusions are not my automated case matching. It's that somebody has to physically go in. So a lot of the things that come up, you know, if a person, an unidentified body has 99 potential matches, 98 of them are not going to be them, maybe even all 99 of them. So they're all going to be exclusions. Will somebody go through the screens and just hit exclude on all of them based on a DNA status? Probably not, unless somebody asks. So somebody with the investigating agent, because that's asking an analyst in a lab to go through a process and bring him back something, you know, it's creating a file, you know, a work that has to be performed by that person. And usually that has to be requested at the investigating agency, is as part of the homicide investigation. They do it all the time. But, you know, physically, unless I have those three things in front of my face that I can actually push the exclude button myself, I can't push it. You know, and I can look at some of these and I know they're not them. I know they're not them. But I don't have any way of clearing them out. So it's a process. It's more complicated on this end than I think people realize. And I began as a cyber sleuth, you know, back in 98. I know so much more now. I see so many mistakes I made that I didn't know that I was doing. At the time, I didn't know any better. And now seeing both sides of it, that's why Namath is publicly available. You want to get this, but it has to be in a very managed process.
Right.
It's not
Todd,
a game,
I have a
you know, it's real. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I have a question. This is from a Web Sleuth member, and I hope I am asking this correctly. Namath has said that the toddler had been there about a year. Is that correct?
The way that I read some of the files, now they're different. Different medical examiners have different ways of putting things. The way that I would understand that person has been deceased for at least a year, you know, and they all
for at least a year.
It's very
okay.
Hard to find. Yeah, that's what I would understand that to say that this person has been deceased for no less than 1 year. I've had a case that was over 100 years old in Kentucky, a body found in construction debris. They thought it was a recent case, a homicide where a body was murdered and put in construction debris. It was over 100 years old. It was a coffin burial.
Wow.
Nobody, you really can't see that in those bones until you go through the material.
Well, Todd Matthews from Namath, as always, thank you so much. We will get our Web Sleuth members working on Peaches, and I have a good feeling about this. Something's going to pop up. And also we'll give them your advice. If they send a link to you, be sure and send the information as to why they are sending you that link on that particular person. So thank you, Todd. Always a pleasure.
All right. Hope to see you again soon.
Thank you, Todd.
Oh, we'll have you
on.
Hopefully next week, maybe something big will break. So take care,
you
Todd.
You never know. I'll see you tomorrow.
Never know.
All righty, bye-bye.
Well, our next guest, I love this title. Robert Anderson is a ripperologist. Love it. Now, Mr. Anderson is going to speak to the forensic footprint, his new victim, one killer versus two killers. And let's go to Mr. Anderson. Robert Anderson, how are you today, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
And,
you're with Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills, so I will turn it over to them for the interview.
Hi.
Hey, Robert. How are you?
Good. Major kudos to you for, one, the series, and two, for the, you know, the link between Peaches and Baby Doe. I mean, real good for you.
Thank you.
Tell us
what you – I have two questions, but the first – so what do you make of all this recent information?
Okay.
I mean, you've been following this case.
Yeah, yes. All right. And, of course, recognize that having failed utterly and miserably in solving the case of Jack the Ripper for 125 years, you know, we are not necessarily the people that will come to you, you know, proposing to solve this one either. But be that as it may, someone had the bright idea of suggesting that we not talk about a Ripper case at a conference just because we've been doing it for a long time. And someone threw out the suggestion of, the, you know, why don't you look at this case on Long Island? And I looked, I said, oh, my God, you know, Gilgo is right next to Tobe, where my parents used to bring me when I was a little child. So it kind of resonated with me, and I think I've said, you know, I come from the same socioeconomic class as the victims, and I have a lot of empathy for the whole situation. You know, I sum it up as there for the, but for the grace of God, go I. So we'll leave it at that. Now, in terms of Peaches and Baby Doe and what it says to me, I'm looking for patterns and messages, and I've been puzzling about, like, why the placement of the bodies in the ritualistic fashion in Gilgo. And, you know, was Lisk trying to make some form of statement with respect to the placement of the bodies? And the question here is, what would, if it's him, or if it's him, you know, what is he trying to say? And I think that the placement of the baby near Jane Doe number 6 is the interesting part to me. Because my picture of Lisk is that someone who's very sadistic and someone very much into control. Right? He's ritualistically placed the 4 victims by the roadside near Ocean Parkway, and he knows he can drive by them if he wants to, and he knows they're there. He's stripped them of their identity. No one knows, you know, that they're actually there. He knows it, derives great pleasure from it. What, you know, could he possibly have been doing in placing the baby so close to Jane Doe number 6 is what intrigues me. And if I'm not wrong, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was about 250 feet away from Baby Doe.
That's correct.
And which harkens back to the 250 foot and 500 foot spacing between the victims at Gilgo. All right, so right there, there's an issue. You know, is this part of that kind of pattern? But more to importantly, what does it say? Well, what is more sadistic than separating a mother and child in death? Right? He could have buried Peaches near, you know, where he left, you know, her dismembered parts, right near Jones Beach. But he deliberately chose to place her near Jane Doe number 6. So it's as if, like, okay, not only did I control you guys in life, I even control you in death. And I'm going to make a sadistic statement by not burying you with your child.
Huh.
So that's kind of where I would come out on it. Now, the biggest problem with all these messages is that when you're dealing with, you know, someone who's possibly insane, you know, they can be sending messages and nobody but them actually would understand what it means. You know, it's like you see a guy in the park on a bench, he's scribbling frantically into a notebook, and you think, my God, this guy must be writing a book or he's a scholar. And so one day you take a look at the page, and it just looks like Egyptian hieroglyphs, and you realize he's just a madman. Well,
right.
You know, these placements don't necessarily mean anything to anything other than Lisk. But I think that the placement of the baby near Jane Doe is an important clue, which I unfortunately don't know what means.
And one other thing, you know, one of the reasons I brought, you know, we interviewed you was because of the torso killing, and
right.
That may have been reminiscent of the Whitechapel murders, and, you know, what was going on with Jack the Ripper and the idea that there could have been 2 serial killers back then. Mike, do you believe that could be true? And then second, how is this case like Jack the Ripper?
Okay. I think that I will, you know, like politicians in debates, you know, like, never actually answer the exact question that was answered. I'm going to turn and say, what about Liskologists reminds me of Ripperologists? And and what it reminds me of is data mining, in that we have a situation in both Ripperology and in this case where a lot of very important facts are derived from the testimony or remarks of just one person. Therefore, you can at any point in time say, you know, that, well, that can't be confirmed. In other words, like Blaze right. says Lisk called him and, you know, multiple amount of times and talked about his tattoos, and then someone will say, well, you know, the only basis for that is an interview Blaze gave for one magazine, and no one else has, you know, been able to confirm that. So you can dismiss it. And so what we always have in Ripperology is people usually write books, and they're pretty much the same for the first 150, 200 pages on basic facts that we can all agree on. Then they take a very dangerous turn because someone will dismiss certain, you know, facts of the case in order to sort of show that their suspect is indeed, you know, the Ripper, you know, and they've managed to solve what we haven't for 125 years. And I think we have the same situation here, where people choose to ignore, you know, facts, and in order to fit a narrative, and it almost always comes back to Oak Beach.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that is unfortunately not helpful. I do think that Shannon Gilbert's death is a tragedy. I certainly feel for the family. They've obviously, you know, suffered further tragedy since then. But I don't think trying to fit the square peg of Shannon Gilbert into the round hole of Gilgo is advancing things very much.
Yeah. I think you and I have been kind of on that same path where we think it was two. But then what about the recent confirmation of the rumors that we've always heard that Burke, you know, and of these alleged sex parties in Gilgo Beach?
Okay. Well, there's two things that come to my head when I immediately upon thinking about Burke going there. One, yes, you could turn around and say that it means that he's an incredibly arrogant son of a bitch, and despite the fact that he participated in these, you know, horrendous series of murders, he had no problem flaunting it and going out to, you know, Oak Beach. Or you could sort of say what's in my mind, which is that he didn't think Oak Beach was a crime scene. So why is he supposed to avoid it? You know, I mean, he obviously feels tremendous entitlement, but he doesn't feel like it's a radioactive area. And this, I would say the same of Lisk, because if you remember, two escorts disappeared after Shannon Gilbert. So
yeah.
Lisk placed them in his usual cemetery, despite Shannon going missing. And if Lisk was responsible for it, you would think he would, trying to see inside the mind of these monsters is usually impossible. But, and I hesitate things like, say, like, oh, if I was Lisk, you know, but I think, you know, I can imagine him taking pause and not using that site after Shannon if he was involved. Because he would have known that area, you know, is potentially very hot. And yet he dumped two more victims there.
Right, which is probably the most compelling evidence yet.
Right, and I'm sort of saying, well, to me, I see something in the same mentality in Burke. If he was up to his eyeballs in heinous things, in doings revolving around Oak Beach, I don't think he would have gone there for a sex party.
Right.
And you could turn around and know a guy's a monster and feels, you know, all these guys feel infinite entitlement. But I think a guy like that, you know, it sounds like he's done a lot of whacked out things over the years. And if he had been, you know, somehow involved with Shannon, I think he would just give the area a wide berth. There's enough.
Yeah.
There's enough other places. You know, Oak Beach isn't anything special.
Right.
Mr. Anderson, can I jump in here and ask a question?
Sure.
First of all, you're a Ripperologist. If you could give us just a quick definition of what that means.
Okay. Well, it's what we call ourselves, and it's people that study the crimes of Jack the Ripper and the ethos of the late Victorian era in England. Mm-hmm. Most sane Ripperologists have long given up trying to solve the case, and what we try to do is fill in, genealogical background on the victims and suspects, and you know, people that have just appeared, you know, in the paper making a casual remark, and actually finding out what happened to the person the rest of their life, and then you know, things like tracking down their descendants. I personally don't do that, but I have a lot of respect for the folks that do. And there's kind of a parallel in terms of the effort here with Namus, right? Because mm-hmm. The people that are doing this are trying to make the Ripper victims, who we know very little about, we're trying to flesh them out as real people.
Right.
And there's one thing I can tell you what a ripperologist is not. A ripperologist is not a fan of Jack the Ripper. You would have to hunt wide and far to find any that are.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, do you think that this case, in 100, 125 years from now, there's going to be somebody, you know, Tricia Arrington Griffith the 10th, asking somebody else about Lisp and when can we solve it?
I think that if Lisk is not dead, and the reason why I throw that out is because, you know, serial killing is not one of the keys to longevity. If he's not dead, he's almost certainly, you know, he's out of the Long Island area. He's obviously been extremely comfortable in Long Island. I mean, I think this guy knows Long Island, you know, like a native, because he was a native. So I think he's relocated, and he's probably relocated to an area he's not as intimately familiar with, and that might lead to a mistake. And he's gone dormant, might go dormant for quite some time, a lot longer than any of us. Well, what am I supposed to say? I don't want more victims, but I'm just saying from standpoint
right.
of, you know, solving it, we need him to make a mistake. And a new territory might create mistakes. I do think that, you know, remember, the FBI was involved in this in the very beginning. You had Suffolk, Nassau County, New York City cops. You had state troopers. You had the FBI. You had a whole lot of people looking at this. I don't think, forensically speaking, there's any evidence. I mean, one thing I keep saying is that I think that while Lisk is not a criminal genius, I think he's forensically aware.
Obviously, because you're right. There isn't any forensics, really.
Right. So
I mean, it's stagnant. It's very frustrating.
It is right. And you think about it, you know, of course, we don't even know for sure that the victims were found in burlap. But, you know, these things create, you know, there's things that can be traced as fiber issues. You know, you're putting bodies. Every time you take a body part and you put it somewhere that it wasn't, you know, where you originally put it, you create a forensic trail, and he's apparently done a great job of keeping it sterile, which gets to one of the other issues that people always had in Jack the Ripper thing. It's like whether or not Jack the Ripper was a trophy taker. And if he was, then perhaps he wasn't a local lunatic, because the local lunatic would like kind of live on the street or in a boarding house and couldn't keep trophies. So the other thing that Peaches to me speaks of is this is a guy that's got storage.
Yeah.
He's a collector. He has storage. And when you have storage, you know, it means you have some part of some piece of property where, you know, you can be unobserved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not all of Long Island. There's plenty of places where the houses, you know, where I grew up, you know, neighbors knew what you were doing.
So yeah, that's right. So in other words, it's hopefully looking hopeful. I agree. I think at some point, if he is still alive, he will make a mistake, or perhaps there'll be some new testing developed that will be able to help us find out who this person is. You say they were very, very comfortable around the Long Island area, but they're not active that we know of. That's the thing, and that's the very scary thing with sex workers is, when they disappear, are they a victim? Are they dead? Or have, you know, and we don't hear about it like we do all the other cases of people disappearing. So
right.
Is it possible he could still be active? We just don't know it.
Because
we haven't found any bodies or anything yet.
All right. What is the saddest part of just the Gilgo Four? It's that some of them, like their family never, no one ever called them in. I mean, Amber?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's just like tragic kind of stuff. And yeah, and then you read, you know, sex workers use, you know, different pseudonyms. They move around. So they go in and off the grid. And I understand, you know, why they create, you know, major, you know, hassles for police in trying to find out where they went. I mean, a lot of them have reasons to leave a particular area. And there's a
right.
there's the drug aspect and all that. So yeah, yes. Is it possible there are victims that are missing as we speak, and we will, you know, we don't know. Yes. But I'm just saying that
well,
you know, hopefully he will make a mistake.
and hopefully he'll make the mistake before he kills another person. Let's keep our fingers crossed and pray for that. Robert Anderson, Ripperologist, we love you. Bessie and I, my producer and administrator at Wolfsloos, were just texting each other about how much we, how cool we think you are. So, you know, you rate as a cool guy. So.
Well, thank you. I'm going to tell my kids that. Thank you.
Dude, tell them that, that two old bats think you're really cool, so that should impress them. Robert Anderson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good night, guys.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Josh and Rachel, Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills, our next guest is John Ray. Mr. Ray, are you there?
I'm right here.
Okay. Mr. Ray has been very active this week, and I'll turn it over to you, Rachel, to kind of go into exactly what's been going on.
Well, you know, I think that we talked about this maybe briefly last week. If not, there was definitely a lot of press surrounding it, is that I was contacted by a sex worker through Twitter, actually. I believe it was Sunday or Monday, who talked to Josh and I, about sex party. She was at Oak Beach, allegedly had sexual relations with ex-Chief Burke back in 2011, a few months, as we spoke about at the top of the hour, after the bodies were found. I believe it was the summer of 2011 when she first started going to these parties. And now Mr. Ray, John Ray, has been working with, we'll call her Leanne, to kind of delve deeper into that. You know, there was a press conference on Thursday. Josh and I were at that. A lot of press were at that. And not sure what's happened since then. Have there been any other developments, Mr. Ray?
Well, sure. There are virtually daily developments, perhaps sometimes three or four times a day. There have been developed that press conference generated enormous amount of contacts, new information. So, yes, there are developments.
Anything, John, that you could speak about or feel comfortable speaking about or give us any indication of what's, you know, something that may feel real or something that may not go anywhere?
Yes. Well, after that press conference with Leanne, there were various people contacted me, some of them with credible evidence, others without. And this is what often happens when you have a big exposure like this. And that's really the purpose of the exposure, you know, quite frankly, is to generate more evidence. That's the direction we're going, is to try always to generate more evidence. And we've never been really dealt with by the police. So, you know, the evidence we receive has never been asked for by the police up until now. And so we just operate on our own. When I say we, I mean the people who are assisting me to try to discover the truth. And so now we have a number of people who have said that they too have knowledge of people who have, you know, been involved in Oak Beach or been involved in something connected to the murders. One of them, a very lovely lady who at one time was an escort and did indeed have relations with Chief Burke. Not at Oak Beach, however, per se, but in various places around Long Island, and for a relatively long time. So she was one of his customers, or he was one of hers, as you wish. You know, and you know, I've learned a great deal from that escort. Another escort has emerged as well. So just those two things alone have emerged. There's been new information about certain other forensic evidence, which we have, which I cannot yet disclose.
But you can
have word that such a thing or things have emerged as well. There's been new evidence that we've acquired regarding Shannon and some of the things that are attached to Shannon. But again, I can't talk to you right now about those things, not yet, until we learn more. But they exist. They are real, and they're forensic in nature. They are, you know, actual evidence rather than surmise. And this escort, the first escort to contact me after Leanne, seemed quite credible. I tried to vet as much as she told me as I could. And it I'd say that she falls down on the credible side for sure.
Oh, that, I mean, you and I speak offline and, you know, we'll, you know, be very transparent. You know, a lot of what we both do is trying to kind of shake the trees, right? To try and get something to happen, somebody to make a mistake, somebody to react, or especially sex workers to come forward to kind of paint a bigger picture of what we're talking about, right?
Well, I guess, Josh, I would say it slightly differently than that, but I don't have any problem with your thought. I would say that, you know, our main purpose is to compel new evidence to come forth, and new evidence in the form of testimony, new evidence in form of physical things, you know, identities, that sort of thing. It's to do that. If people come forward with it, fine. If they don't, because of our work, then we have failed. But I would be delighted to take the evidence which I have gathered over the course of 5 years now, and well, I think we're reaching up into the 900 hours range of work, and gladly share it with authorities who really have an intention of using it or discarding it after they've used it, as the case may be. I'm willing to do that. But where the authorities have not requested it and have no interest in it, I'm left to just fend for myself as you are and do the best we can with what we have. That's all I'm doing. I don't pretend to be the authority on all of this, nor do I have any authority beyond my ability as a civil attorney and private citizen to do what I'm doing.
Right.
Have you spoken to law enforcement since the press conference at all?
I have not spoken to any law enforcement whatsoever. None have contacted me. I have been told through hearsay that various law enforcement authorities are not well pleased that these things are done by media, these exposures of witnesses. But, you know, I don't know that I have any other choice. I mean, I could just keep it quiet. And what value does that have in the end? It doesn't generate more evidence. I've been 34 years at this, and as you know, I've had countless high-profile cases in all different areas of law. And without fail, going public and having the media cover the case generates witnesses, evidence, and sometimes decisively so. You know, all the way back to, for example, the surrogate parent case I had, that we won the case because the media generated witnesses. It happens that way. So we're happy to have it.
And
Josh,
and
do you have a question?
Well, I guess the feds haven't contacted you.
The feds, I haven't heard from yet. I would hope that they would, but that's their choice, their call. I have other evidence that I'm not revealing, but they haven't called me. Suffolk County Police, Homicide Squad promised back a year ago that they would cooperate with me. They reached out to me and said, we'll cooperate with you. We'll meet with you. I gave them several opportunities to do that. They never called me back, and to this date, I've never heard from any of them.
Right. And one other question. So you've heard rumors for a long time that Burke took part in these quote-unquote sex parties that happened in Oak Beach, and now you finally have a sworn affidavit to do so. How does this impact the 911 call in terms of what you assumed it to be, and does this compel the courts maybe to consider making it public even more or less?
Well, I you know, taking it backwards from your question, the last one first, I don't think that the court, if it, when it acts properly, and I think this court acts properly, this judge that we have, takes into account public pressure or, you know, immediate jazzy things like this witness coming forward. It to the court has to determine the case on the law and the facts presented to it. It can't determine it based on these other, you know, miscellaneous pressures that exist. So I don't expect the court to be affected this way or that by this revelation. The court, that is to say, that's sitting both on the motion to dismiss our case and the motion for to compel the county to give us the 911 tapes. However,
right.
You know, how else does it affect the case? Well, I don't know from this evidence more than what the evidence itself says. The affidavit speaks for itself, just as Leanne did speak for herself. In other words, what she says happened, we'll take at face value that it happened, because we vet her and she appears to be credible on that issue. What
right.
does that mean? That does not mean that we have conclusory evidence that Burke killed anybody or that he had anything to do with the deaths of these people. It does not give us evidence that Burke conspired to cover it up. The killings, as it were, it doesn't do any of that. But what it does do is it moves him from, shall we say, a neutral position where he might be connected coincidentally to the case in some way into a circle where he could be a suspect himself or he could be a suspect in attempting to subvert, cover up, or pervert the investigation. And those things need to be looked at further and more closely. So he could be that. And now, which was not emphasized at the press conference, I have now found for the first time evidence, and I call it's very solid documentary evidence, that Peter Hackett, Dr. Hackett, and Burke worked together on the Flight 800 crash in the medical examiner's office in the recovering of dead flesh. And that puts them very closely, intimately together since 1997. And it puts them together on a very unusual situation, the dead. So how does that work? What does it mean? We shall see. We don't know yet. But it moves them into close contact with each other, which before we did not know except by surmise. Now we know. And that's consistent with many of the theories that are out there. That doesn't prove anything yet.
Right.
So I don't think that Burke's involvement in any way diminishes the evidence that we have of Hackett's involvement.
Right.
At all. If anything, it may enhance it.
Right.
I from a WebClues member, if I may, Mr. Ray, it we've kind of already gone over this, but it seemed like it was going to be a he said, she said type thing. But yours, as far as court having, you know, relations with the former chief of police, but now you're saying there is definitely forensic evidence, so it's not going to be a he said, she said thing. It's going to be something that, with this evidence, will be pretty cut and dry?
Nothing is cut and dry, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with this entire case, is that it's on a mystery level, probably now greater than the mystery of who was Jack the Ripper. There's just no direct evidence of who is the killer, direct evidence, you know, that's the problem. But with the growing evidence, the circumstantial evidence is growing stronger and stronger by the day as to two things. First, that the death of Shannon Gilbert is consistent with murder, and that Peter Hackett his behavior is consistent with her death. Secondly, what's growing and growing is that Burke, Chief Burke, is involved in some way with Oak Beach and prostitutes who are the same subject matter of the, as those who are dead, the 11 dead people that are found in Gilgo Beach and Oak Beach at the same time that Burke is involved in prostitution.
Right.
So we have that evidence. We have, you know, now I have actual testimonial evidence as well that, you know, that Burke certainly did solicit prostitutes and even ran prostitutes out of his beeper phone and was involved in Oak Beach drug and sex parties. I mean, that certainly anybody can see that moves Burke closer to the center of this controversy.
Yeah,
it certainly does. It certainly does. And Mr. Ray, I own and operate a wonderful community of web sleuthers. It's called WebSleuth.com, and we've actually taken on trying to help Josh and Rachel. And is there anything we can do for you and your situation personally? Because it's really like just having an army sitting here saying, "What do I do next? Give me something to dig into. Give me an idea, and I'll run with it." Is there anything that we can do to help you?
Well, yes, I suppose there is, you know, in a number of ways. We need help. I don't have the capacity to keep up with all of the evidence that's pouring in and match it up with various things. We're trying, but we certainly need help from people who have a good, strong, professional background. That could, if they would come forward to help us, we would welcome that help in my office.
I'm sure they will now. They will now.
Yeah, we have a former homicide detective from Suffolk County helping us mm-hmm. who came forward. We have an international forensic technological expert helping us. We found Dr. Budden. He helped us. We're willing to, you know, work with whoever can come forward and help us because I can't do this alone. The second thing you can do is if you come across evidence, whether it's questionable or not, pitch it over to us. Let us look at it. We have, you know, a lot more evidence than most people do. Maybe we can match it up with something. Maybe we can't, but it's worth letting us know.
Right. Can you tell us, John, has anything you want to make public since the press conference? Can you give us anything new that we can kind of sink our teeth into?
Well, other than what I said, we do have, I have another former escort who's given us a statement as to exactly what her relationship was with Burke and the way the sexual, his sexual proclivities were, and they seem to match what we heard from Leanne and from others. That's come into, you know, that's only, the press conference was what, on Thursday, I think? And here we are. Yeah, we're not even a week later, and that's already come into our hands. And then there are other things I cannot give you yet, but that much I can give you.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Ray, I can't thank you enough for coming on, even though you're giving us these incredible pieces of information, but you can't reveal it to us. You have all this evidence, and we're going to go crazy trying to think of what it is, but we understand the need to keep it, definitely keep it to yourself for right now. But at some point, I know we'll be able to see it, and I can't wait for that moment. And we'll certainly check with our Web Sleuth members that are from all over the world and see what kind of help we can get you so you don't have to have everything, you know, piled
right
on you. So, like I said, we're an army just waiting for orders, so just consider it done, okay?
There is what the public knows, what's put in the papers, and then there is the politics. And,
mm-hmm.
man, it is black and white. It's gray. It's everything. There's, you know what I'm saying? It's like the public hears about a killer and some women and, you know, people disappearing, and then there's, like, what's really going on. And
exactly.
When you get into it, It's crazy, you know. It's this whole another level of crime that may or may not be related. I mean, this is this whole thing about conspiracy, and it's something that I think Rach and I tried to address. It's like some people say Burke's the killer. We're of course never saying that, and we don't allege that. But it's very hard for people to distinguish between what's somebody covering up their own bad behavior, which ends up looking like covering up, you know, murder. And I think that's one of the places where it's really difficult in the List case. We never know, are we seeing somebody who's like covering up for a murder or covering up for some other thing that they did, which they don't want to get out. But
and then that just makes them look guilty for the murder.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're trying to cover something up. But it's just a circle that just vicious circle just goes around and around and eats everybody alive. So Burke's trying to, you know, cover up the fact that he used prostitutes and you know that whole story. He's trying to cover it up. Well, a lot of people will logically think, why is he trying to hide that? Well, obviously, police chief, you know, hooking up with escorts is not a good thing, and that's, you know, that's, he'll say that's why he's trying to cover it up. But a lot of people are going to say, well, that must be because he did it. And, you know, it's a logical way of thinking. We just don't have any proof of it, and there's no, you know, we're certainly not accusing him, but when you act like that, that's where people go, you know?
Right. Well, and I think just the sad reality is, you know, again, we're not saying he is the killer, but the sad reality is that when you are trying to cover your tracks for whatever is maybe not even related to the Gilgo investigation, is that it becomes muddled. You know, facts, leads are gone into the ether because you're trying to cover your tracks for other things. And that's really tragic. That's really sad that the fallout, the ramifications are affected in other cases. And I bet that goes beyond the Gilgo investigation as well.
Yeah,
it very well could. This could reach out in all different areas. And that's kind of scary to think about. This is just one little, you know, one small area in the United States. It's like, what else is going on with other police departments? It's very, very shocking to, you know, people like me, middle America, who think cops are here doing their job. It's like, wow, this police chief was really doing this? It's just appalling. But, again,
it's
reality.
Right. And, you know, I think also power corrupts, you know, and I think, I really think what Burke was doing is way outside of many other law enforcement agencies in the United States. You know, I think he is the anomaly. There is not a lot, that is not going on all over the place. We were
so
shocked.
So. It is. It's absolutely appalling. But, okay, you know, you weren't going to be on this week because we had kind of wrapped everything up and we were just status quo kind of going on. But with all the new information coming out, we decided to do another show. And so how about this? How about if you just both of you take a minute or so or 30 seconds just to wrap things up on your thoughts and where we go from here? And, Rachel, why don't you start?
Well,
no, you go ahead, Josh. Please.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Rach, because we're not in the same room. Can we talk about what we were going to talk about? Can we mention it?
Oh,
yes.
I would love to mention it, actually. Can I go ahead and talk about it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's so interesting. I feel like we've been inundated with new leads, new tips, new clues over the past week with Peaches, with Burke. But looking back to Peaches, it's so interesting. You know, Josh and I have been looking at this tattoo for, I don't know, 4 years since we started this whole thing. And it was actually after your radio show last week on Tuesday, after Melissa Cann called in. That's Marie and Brainerd Barnes' sister, the first at Go-Go Beach 4 to go missing. She contacted me a couple of hours later, and said, Rachel, have you looked at the Peaches tattoo and noticed some initials? And I was like, huh, what are you talking about? I've looked at that Peaches tattoo hundreds of times. And I look at it, and I swear, and I do think there are initials there. There's some high-resolution photos out there So we're talking about Peaches. We're talking about Peaches with the Peaches tattoo, the body found in 97. We talked about this person, this unidentified victim earlier. It looks like a very high caliber tattoo, but if you look on the left-hand side, it's one of the green leaves on the left-hand side. There's a letter T, there's a letter B, and there's a third letter, which in my opinion, it looks like an A, maybe it's a P, but it looks like initials. It looks like maybe TBA. So this is something that I think the Websuits community is one of the best things they can do is kind of what's TBA? Is this initials for her? Is this maybe the toddler's initials? Is this crew or gang related? Is this a tattoo that was covered up, you know, with the peaches made on her body to cover up another tattoo? Was this her pimp?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different things that this could be. In my opinion, you know, Peaches links to Atlanta, links to Georgia. Is there a crew, a gang down there with the initials TBA? I think we've done a little bit of research, but I think that is some of the best kind of work that Websuits can do. So I'm really interested in what Websuits has to come up with.
I am so glad you said something, because this is absolutely perfect for our Websuits members. And by the time, you know, we're done with this show, people will already be started looking at it and trying to come up with it. And we'll put it out there, and the whole world on Websuits will be able to look at it. And I have a feeling that somebody will come up with the answer, because they always seem to, whenever they're given a piece of evidence, you know, they can really just bear down on it and find out what it means. That is so cool. That's great.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Our goal has always been to ask, I mean, because we want to prove this for law enforcement, right? What we want to do is we want to say, all right, Web Sleuth community, here's a tip, go. So if we can solve this, I think we can convince more law enforcement to use Web Sleuths to solve other tidbits of crime. So
if
Trish, would you put this new tattoo with a higher definition, would you put it on the front page of the website, and would you ask everybody to please, you know, start, maybe we can even make go to the Peaches thread and start putting what it is, and Rach and I will start looking at that thread, and it would be just amazing if we could ID Peaches.
Totally. And just to piggyback on that as well, is that you know, I know there's different like color saturation. I know probably some of the web sleuthers are really good at, you know, maybe unsaturating the photo to show actually the initials. And if we can, you know, in NamUs, they will put more information on there. If we can convince them that this is actually a tattoo, they will add that information to NamUs, saying, you know, it's a Peaches tattoo with the initials XYZ. You know what I mean? So then it's even outside of the Websuits community, it's public information. So I'd love for us to just kind of hone in on that. If there's Websuiters who are really good with photographs and bringing that out and figuring out exactly what are those initials. And maybe we're singing something that's not there. I disagree with that. I think there is something there. But let's just make sure. Let's figure out what this is. Because there's
absolutely.
I think there is something there.
Hey, Bessie is the administrator in the Killing Season Forum, and she's also my producer during the show. Bessie, what do you think about this? I mean, this is like candy to me. I just love this. Give us something that we can put on Websuits, let everybody know.
It is like candy, and we already have, you know, sleuthers on it. I have my own ideas, what I think is good. But
what
I
is your
say,
idea?
No, I actually think it's an AP, I mean, ABP, and I think you said you think it's an ABA?
TBA. TBA.
TBA.
I mean, TBA, TBA, and I think it's TBP, but, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Neither here nor there. We already have some sleuthers who have done some, you know, work in Photoshop to try to enhance it, and
right.
see if we can get a definite on whether it's, you know, TBP or TBA. I also, I'm curious if there's a connection maybe to, you know, between Atlanta and South Carolina, which isn't that far because we have another, in a totally separate case, there was a body found here in New Orleans with a strawberry tattoo that had a sort of a similar look. And she was traced to South Carolina, I think Columbia, South Carolina. So, you know, it could be sort of a gang crew symbol or, you know, or initials. I don't know. It's just a wild guess right now. But believe me, the sleuthers are on it, and I'll, you know, bump it up again, and we will give it a lot of exposure as much as we can.
We'll put it on the front page tonight. Yeah.
Yeah. But you guys have done great, and I just want to say this real quickly. Thank you so much. You've driven some energy and momentum into this long, lingering case that it got to the point where, you know, the forum was almost dead because there was nowhere else to go. So you've given it some momentum, and thank you so very much for doing that because we want to see these cases solved.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I love
it. A lot of hard work.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Josh. What did you say?
All right, guys. Well, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
And happy
holidays
to both of you.
Yes.
You too.
Happy holidays. And, hey, who knows? Maybe next week you'll be on again because something big broke. I would love it. Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills from The Killing Season, thank you so much. I know we'll be talking to you again soon. Take care
you
now.
Will.
And Bethany,
thank you so much
for doing the heavy lifting. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll get right on that Peaches tattoo. And hopefully within a short period of time, we'll figure out what those initials are. Okay? Web Sleuth Radio, Trish Griffith is saying bye-bye. See you next week. Same place, same time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye, guys.